Chapter 6. In silence they waited through an interval which seemed endless. At length a sound, and an approaching object, proved to them that the driver of the mail car had been as good as his word. A farmer's man from near Storecastle came up, leading a strong cob. He was harnessed to the wagon of Beehives in the place of Prince, and the load taken on towards Casterbridge. The evening of the same day saw the empty wagon reach again the spot of the accident. Prince had lain there in the ditch since the morning, but the place of the blood pool was still visible in the middle of the road, though scratched and scraped over by passing vehicles. All that was left of Prince was now hoisted into the wagon he had formerly hauled, and with his hoofs in the air, and his shoes shining in the setting sunlight, he retracted the 8 or 9 miles to Marlott. Tess had gone back earlier. How to break the news was more than she could think. It was a relief to her tongue to find from the faces of her parents that they already knew of their loss, though this did not lessen the self-reproach which she continued to heap upon herself for her negligence. But the very shiftlessness of the household rendered the misfortune a less terrifying one to them than it would have been to a thriving family, though in the present case it meant ruin, and in the other it would only have meant inconvenience. In the Derbyfield countenances there was nothing of the red wrath that would have burned upon the girl from parents more ambitious for her welfare. Nobody blamed Tess as she blamed herself. When it was discovered that the knacker and tanner would give only a very few shillings for Prince's carcass, because of his decrepitude, Derbyfield rose to the occasion. "No," said he stoically, "I won't sell his old body. When we D'Urbervilles was knights in the land, we didn't sell our chargers for cat's meat. Let 'em keep their shillings. He've served me well in his lifetime, and I won't part from him now." He worked harder the next day in digging a grave for Prince in the garden than he had worked for months, to grow a crop for his family. When the hole was ready, Derbyfield and his wife tied a rope round the horse, and dragged him up the path towards it, the children following in funeral train. Abraham and Liza Lou sobbed, Hope and Modest discharged their griefs in loud blares which echoed from the walls, and when Prince was tumbled in they gathered round the grave. The breadwinner had been taken away from them. What would they do? "Is he gone to heaven?" asked Abraham, between the sobs. Then Derbyfield began to shovel in the earth, and the children cried anew. All except Tess. Her face was dry and pale, as though she regarded herself in the light of a murderess. The haggling business, which had mainly depended on the horse, became disorganized forthwith. Distress, if not penury, loomed in the distance. Derbyfield was what was locally called a slack-twisted fellow. He had good strength to work at times, but the times could not be relied on to coincide with the hours of requirement, and, having been unaccustomed to the regular toil of the day laborer, he was not particularly persistent when they did so coincide. Tess, meanwhile, as the one who had dragged her parents into this quagmire, was silently wondering what she could do to help them out of it, and then her mother broached her scheme. "We must take the ups why the downs, Tess," said she, "and never could your high blood have been found out at a more called for moment. You must try your friends. Do ye know that there is a very rich Mrs. D'Urberville living on the outskirts o' the chase, who must be our relation? You must go to her and claim kin, and ask for some help in our trouble." "I shouldn't care to do that," says Tess. "If there is such a lady, 'twould be enough for us, if she were friendly, not to expect her to give us help. You could win her round to do anything, my dear. Besides, perhaps there's more in it than you know of. I've heard what I've heard, good now." The oppressive sense of the harm as he had done led Tess to be more deferential than she might otherwise have been to the maternal wish, but she could not understand why her mother should find such satisfaction in contemplating an enterprise of, to her, such doubtful profit. Her mother might have made inquiries, and have discovered that this Mrs. D'Urberville was a lady of unequaled virtues and charity, But Tessa's pride made the part of poor relation one of particular distaste to her. I'd rather try to get work, she murmured. Derbyfield, you can settle it, said his wife, turning to where he sat in the background. If you say she ought to go, she will go. I don't like my children going and making themselves beholden to strange kin, murmured he. I'm the head of the noblest branch of the family, and I ought to live up to it. His reasons for staying away were worse to Tess than her own objections to going. Well, as I killed the horse, mother, she said mournfully, I suppose I ought to do something. I don't mind going and seeing her, but you must leave it to me about asking for help. And don't go thinking about her making a match for me, it is silly. Be very well said, Tess, observed her father sententiously. Who said I had such a thought? Asked Joan. I fancy it is in your mind, mother. But I'll go. Rising early next day she walked to the hill town called Shaston, and there took advantage of a van which twice in the week ran from Shaston eastward to Chaseborough, passing near Trantridge, the parish in which the vague and mysterious Mrs. D'Urberville had a residence. Tess Derbyfield's route on this memorable morning lay amid the northeastern undulations of the vale in which she had been born, and in which her life had unfolded. The Vale of Blackmoor was to her the world, and its inhabitants the races thereof. From the gates and stiles of Marlett she had looked down its length in the wandering days of infancy, and what had been mystery to her then was not much less than mystery to her now. She had seen daily from her chamber window towers, villages, faint white mansions, above all the town of Shaston standing majestically on its height, its windows shining like lamps in the evening sun. She had hardly ever visited the place, only a small tract even of the vale, and its environs being known to her by close inspection. Much less had she been far outside the valley. Every contour of the surrounding hills was as personal to her as that of her relatives' faces, but for what lay beyond her judgment was dependent on the teaching of the village school, where she had held a leading place at the time of her leaving, a year or two before this date. In those early days she had been much loved by others of her own sex and age, and had used to be seen about the village as one of three all nearly of the same year walking home from school side by side. Tess the middle one in a pink print pinafore, of a finely reticulated pattern, worn over a stuff frock that had lost its original color for a nondescript tertiary marching on upon long stocky legs, in tight stockings which had little ladder-like holes at the knees, torn by kneeling in the roads, and banks in search of vegetable and mineral treasures, her then earth-colored hair handing like pot hooks, the arms of the two outside girls resting round the waist of Tess, her arms on the shoulders of the two supporters. As Tess grew older, and began to see how matters stood, she felt quite a Malthusian towards her mother for thoughtlessly giving her so many little sisters and brothers, when it was such a trouble to nurse and provide for them. Her mother's intelligence was that of a happy child. Joan Derbyfield was simply an additional one, and that not the eldest, to her own long family of waiters on Providence. However, Tess became humanely beneficent towards the small ones, and to help them as much as possible she used, as soon as she left school, to lend a hand at haymaking or harvesting on neighboring farms, or, by preference, at milking or butter-making processes, which she had learned when her father had owned cows, and being deft-fingered it was a kind of work in which she excelled. Every day seemed to throw upon her young shoulders more of the family burdens, and that Tess should be the representative of the Derbyfields at the D'Urberville mansion came as a thing of course. In this instance it must be admitted that the Derbyfields were putting their fairest side outward. She alighted from the van at Trantridge Cross, and ascended on foot a hill in the direction of the district known as the Chase, on the borders of which, as she had been informed, Mrs. D'Urberville's seat, the Slopes, would be found. It was not a manorial home in the ordinary sense, with fields, and pastures, and a grumbling farmer, out of whom the owner had to squeeze an income for himself, and his family by hook or by crook. It was more, far more, a country house built for enjoyment, pure and simple, with not an acre of troublesome land attached to it beyond what was required for residential purposes, and for a little fancy farm kept in hand by the owner, and tended by a bailiff. The Crimson Brick Lodge came first in sight, up to its eaves in dense evergreens. Tess thought this was the mansion itself till, passing through the side wicket with some trepidation, and onward to a point at which the drive took a turn, the house proper stood in full view. It was of recent erection, indeed almost new, and of the same rich red color that formed such a contrast with the evergreens of the lodge. Far behind the corner of the house, which rose like a geranium bloom against the subdued colors around, stretched the soft azure landscape of the chase, a truly venerable tract of forest land, one of the few remaining woodlands in England of undoubted primeval date, wherein druidical mistletoe was still found on aged oaks, and where enormous yew trees, not planted by the hand of man, grew as they had grown, when they were pollarded for boughs. All this sylvan antiquity, however, though visible from the slopes, was outside the immediate boundaries of the estate. Everything on this snug property was bright, thriving, and well kept. Acres of glass houses stretched down the inclines to the copses at their feet. Everything looked like money, like the last coin issued from the mint. The stables, partly screened by Austrian pines and evergreen oaks, and fitted with every late appliance, were as dignified as chapels of ease. On the extensive lawn, stood an ornamental tent, its door being towards her. Simple Tess Durbeyfield stood at gaze, in a half-alarmed attitude, on the edge of the gravel sweep. Her feet had brought her onward to this point before as he had quite realized where she was, and now all was contrary to her expectation. "I thought we were an old family, but this is all new," she said, in her artlessness. She wished that as he had not fallen in so readily with her mother's plans for claiming kin, and had endeavored to gain assistance nearer home. The D'Urbervilles, or Stoke D'Urbervilles, as they at first called themselves who owned all this, were a somewhat unusual family to find in such an old-fashioned part of the country. Parson Tringham had spoken truly when he said that our shambling John Durbeyfield was the only really lineal representative of the old D'Urberville family existing in the county, or near it. He might have added, what he knew very well, that the Stoke D'Urbervilles were no more D'Urbervilles of the true tree than he was himself. Yet it must be admitted that this family formed a very good stock whereon to regraft a name which sadly wanted such renovation. When old Mr. Simon Stoke, latterly deceased, had made his fortune as an honest merchant, some said money lender, in the north, he decided to settle as a county man in the south of England, out of hail of his business district. And in doing this, he felt the necessity of recommencing with a name that would not too readily identify him with the smart tradesmen of the past, and that would be less commonplace than the original bald, stark words. Conning for an hour in the British Museum the pages of works devoted to extinct, half-extinct, obscured, and ruined families appertaining to the quarter of England in which he proposed to settle, he considered that D'Urberville looked and sounded as well as any of them. And D'Urberville accordingly was annexed to his own name for himself and his heirs eternally. Yet he was not an extravagant-minded man in this, and in constructing his family tree on the new basis, was duly reasonable in framing his intermarriages and aristocratic links, never inserting a single title above a rank of strict moderation. Of this work of imagination, poor Tess and her parents were naturally in ignorance much to their Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.